Good day, gentlemen. This is Justin Lamoureux from Rainy Day Forge, and you're listening to The Builder Sessions.
Welcome to The Builder Sessions, a podcast where we chat with your favorite builders.
We get to know them, their stories, and hopefully inspire you to get off the couch and build something cool. I'm Hoff.
And I'm Rosie.
And on today's episode, we have Justin Lamoureux from Rainy Day Forge. We chat about combining one's passions to pursue entrepreneurship, acquiring equipment and tools within your means when first starting out, and he busts some common myths about blacksmithing and Damascus steel.
Please enjoy our interview with Justin. Justin, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Happy to be here, guys. I was listening this morning and I like what you guys are doing.
We really appreciate that.
It's good to hear.
Yeah, it's really good because there's always that like, is this a thing that people are going to listen to or whatever? And it's exciting for us. It's the best like professional and personal development. You're just talking with all these amazing people.
Definitely. Definitely.
For those of our listeners who are unfamiliar with yourself and Rainy Day Forge, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, well, we were talking about it before going on the air there, but common theme, I'm an ex-teacher. I was teaching for about 13 years in middle years, so I wasn't the shops teacher. And I got into filming, and filming got me into entrepreneurship, and entrepreneurship led me down the line of making knives. And I guess prior to education was working in industry as well. So I was working for Lund Boats and a bus company here in Winnipeg, and really liked that aspect. And I've always been an outdoorsy kind of guy, canoeing, camping, hiking, and always had a knife, an axe, a saw along with me. And I was like, Forge and Fire came on TV and I was like, look at these guys making knives. I want to do that.
Let's figure it out.
So I like got into prior to jumping down that rabbit hole was like going to auctions and looking at all these cool old tools and like trying to find an anvil. Got suckered into like filling up my truck so many times at like the end of the auctions where they're like a dollar. I'm looking at you, Justin. It's like, okay,
that's the best part.
Yeah. First name basis with the auctioneer.
Yeah. So that pretty much allowed me to like kit out my shop slowly with like crappy shelves to better shelving to
probably affordably too now. Right, being able to purchase that? Affordably, being able to go to the auctions and getting, not having to drop, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to
exactly.
Get started.
Yeah, totally. So that kind of sent me down the rabbit hole of making knives, and now I do it full-time from home here. And yeah, well, full-time supplemented by my wife's finances as
yeah,
well
of
she
course
works full-time right? As a teacher as well, so she's the financier of Rainy Day Forge.
she's the sugar mama, hey.
she certainly is. I'm really, really fortunate to have someone in my corner that's like, you know, you love this, you're passionate about it, and you want to like pursue it. And teaching is slowly killing your soul.
Yeah.
Sorry, teachers.
No, yeah.
I think part of that was mixed with COVID, but yeah, that's my that's my rough history behind what brought me to make knives.
I think that's good for you for not just sticking in it just for the money or whatever, right? Like, I think that's really admirable. To be like, you know, identify, okay, this is not feeding my soul. It's sucking it dry. Like it's like draining it. So I'm out.
Yeah. You know, honestly, I loved it. I loved the relations with the relationships with the students, the way the interactions in class and inspiring them and making them into better individuals. But it was a lot of the, like, the fluff and the, maybe if I would have had administrators that are inspiring, that pushed me, that would have been like, you've got this and you can, like, we can change people and like really have an impact. But it was always like, hang in there, guys. Yeah. The end is coming. And it was always like doom and gloom. And it was like, I that doesn't really do it for me. I need to be like, I need to be, I don't know, lifted up a little bit. Yeah. So
we all have those teachers, or I shouldn't say all, but there are some of those teachers, whether it's been in early years, middle school, high school, that, you know, kind of on their last way out, or they're not enjoying it. And you can definitely tell.
Oh,
you know,
dude.
So, yeah. So to be able to check yourself and be like, you know what, this, I'm not having fun, or I'm not happy. I'm sure the students can see that. So good for you to get out and do something that you enjoy, put a smile on your face.
And honestly, it's something that I would go back to. So
that's cool.
Still love it. Yeah. Still love it.
Teach,
I just
teach a fabrication this year. Class.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I have a friend that's a shops teacher, and he's like, go back to school, get your certificate for teaching shops. But I'm like, I don't know if I can do a year of schooling at this point. Like,
it's hard to go from hands-on into the trades back to school again.
And honestly, the position I'm in, I'm French. I've always taught at French schools. Okay. And the need for teachers right now is quite high. Like, I can make a few phone calls tomorrow and get a job if I wanted. Yeah.
I like.
I don't.
I don't. Let's be clear. Anyone listening? Yeah.
You're too busy forging.
Yeah.
Why would you want to? Why do you want to get off that?
I found it interesting too when you were talking about how you got into the Rainy Day Forge stuff. How you went from video first, to then knives. Because a lot of times it's like you have this hobby, whatever, if it's autos or woodworking or forging, and then you're like, oh, maybe I should. You know, it seems like the common path is to get into that craft and then start making videos about it. But yours was the opposite. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Like, as a kid, my parents had a little handheld camera, and I always enjoyed messing around with it. And I was like the kid that took like everything apart and, oh, a toy for Christmas. It's awesome. It's coming apart like as soon as the wheel falls off, right? And video camera was kind of one of those devices that just, it wouldn't break. So I enjoyed playing with it. And then when I was a teacher, I took a small like day course. Like, you've always got the development courses, and it was like a half day on videography and teaching kids how to make videos. Rabbit hole again. Like, this is awesome. I love this. We're going to do this in class, like storytelling. And we did it. I did it for, I don't know, 5 years, where we'd submit to a little film contest here in the city. And then 1 year I had a group that was a little difficult. And I was like, yeah, you guys, we're not going to do it this year. It's too much. And I'm going to do it. So I went on to make my own project, and we filmed wakeboarding. I was into board sports, snowboarding, wakeboarding. Yeah.
Nice.
And and like, that goes hand in hand. What do you do when you're not behind the boat? You're filming, or you're driving, or you're encouraging.
Yeah.
And a buddy of mine had made a wakeboard film, just filming over a summer. And then we teamed up together to do another summer. And then we decided, well, I decided, let's hang on to this footage and film for another year and turn it into a documentary. And so I don't know if that answers your question.
That's cool.
We went to Churchill wakeboarding and released the documentary. We went to like Yorkton Film Festival.
Wow.
I was up against the Great Canadian Race in my category, and I was like, okay, you guys win for sure. Yeah. Like, this is impossible. I can't like beat out millions of dollars of budget, where we ran an Indiegogo campaign to fund it. And just a great time, huge learning experience, just like massive.
That's cool to have a passion of wakeboarding and board sports, and then to be on the video end of it. I grew up wakeboarding and surfing and snowboarding, so I can relate to that, having that, like, something about being on the boat. But like you said, when you're either driving the boat or you're a passenger, to have a video filming that. I've always loved watching wakeboard videos and just the action sports and being able to get that on camera right. must be a really cool experience for you.
Well, at a point, your body kind of doesn't want to hold up, right? So that was always like reading in the magazines. I was a huge nut. Like I love that stuff. And in the magazines, it would be like, once you're aching, like your job is to start documenting and taking pictures. And I was like, I love that stuff. Like I had a little camera from back in the day. Let's bring that in the boat. And it just like developed and developed into me spending like, I don't know, 10,000 plus on my camera rig to like get some good content. And then I discovered like actual storytelling. Yeah. So that brought me into like, let's make an actual documentary. Let's do something stupid that we can't do, guys. Let's go to Churchill. Let's go wakeboarding out there and we'll film it all. And hopefully we don't get eaten by polar bears.
So how did you get in from filming wakeboarding to forging now? I feel like you've got a lot of little...
This is awesome.
Dude, I've got a life of cool tangents. Yeah.
I love
this
it.
On the
yeah.
show.
Yeah. All right. So I was looking at starting a business in cinematography, like filming yeah. short business video, like commercials for small businesses. I couldn't get motivated. Like I couldn't get the gas to flow properly for that. And during that time period, I was also interested in knives. So I was like, okay, well, I'll start filming to practice myself in the shop. So I'll do that. And that led me to make a YouTube channel. I don't do like a lot at this, or I wasn't doing it a lot, but I was learning slowly in the shop to do it myself. And yeah, that just kind of led me to like, all right, what's the next project that I can film? And it was like, okay, screw filming. I just want to make the knives because like it takes double or triple the amount of time to film making a knife than just actually making a knife. So it led me to make more knives.
Yeah. So as far as making knives goes, obviously, and this is another kind of theme that we're picking up as we're going along. This whole idea of, you know, you don't necessarily have to, if you want to dabble in an area and become yeah. an expert in something, you don't necessarily have to go to school. So you didn't, mm-hmm. I don't think you went to blacksmith school. So no. Tell me about that journey and how you, because, okay, I like building knives, but how did you learn about it? Was it just like a YouTube wormhole or a rabbit hole, I mean, or was like, did you get a mentor? Like, what was that journey like?
Yeah, it's strangely enough, again, YouTube, but also connecting with one particular blacksmith or bladesmith on there. Like people look at YouTube as being just a place to consume information, and largely it is, right? But it's also a social network. Like you comment on videos, people reply, people try to guide you to other videos that might be helpful. So you actually do make some connections on YouTube. And one of the guys that really I resonated with his content was Niels Vandenberg, and he's out of South Africa near Johannesburg.
Wow.
Yeah, just a bundle of energy, a huge character, but like amazingly skilled, like really, really good. Like if anyone hit pause, go check out his work. His daggers are amazing.
We'll link to it in the show notes.
Yeah, good, good. Yeah, he made Master Smith this year because oh, wow. there's a program of like to become a junior smith and then a master smith. And he won like a special award this year. Like not only your master smith, but you're winning this extra award of, reconnaissance. Like, I don't know how to say it in English.
Oh, okay. Oh, gotcha.
French is my first language.
All good. All good. So you've started following him and
yep.
after follow, so like, obviously, did you reach out to him, connect with him? Like what was that?
Not at first. No, it was often just like, he's got a whole line of tutorials on okay. his YouTube channel. They're probably like 10 years old now. And you can just go from video one to video 50, and they're all about 5-10 minutes long. And it's like how to profile a tip, how to grind, how to make a sheath, how to like everything that you need to really know how to start making basic knives.
Yeah.
And through that, like first session of watching it and the second session of watching it, and practicing in between, making mistakes, right? It's not working out. What didn't I pick up in that video? And you watch it again. And it's like, oh, okay, I wasn't ready to learn that yet. Now that I've acquired an anvil, have the hammer work and have made a few hammers, I can learn it now. So going back and rewatching it all helped. And now I don't need to refer to it very often. It's great.
That's cool.
So lots of trial and error and go back to the drawing board. And I think that speaks volumes to be able to, lots of people say social media and different things, they're positive and negatives. But with that, I'm a very visual learner myself. So being able to go watch somebody on YouTube and then go back and give it a shot and kind of reference that's a really cool resource to have and to have at your disposal and to be able to go back and forth and not have to read through, you know, like in the old days, the Haynes manuals or, you know, service manuals or how to do something. Now you've got the visual, you've got auditory, and you've got time on your side to kind of play around and have fun and learn.
No kidding. Yeah, definitely. I still sit down in my shop and pull out my phone and be like, okay, how do I do this again? Like, and now it, instead of like, how do I make the knife? It's more about the heat treatment, because you've got all these different types of steel that have all these different properties that all need a different form of heat treatment. You want to hit certain temperatures at different speed rates and cooling rates and like different quenchants.
That's insane. Was it intimidating to even get into it? Like knowing that there are all these different things you need to consider, like speed, like I knew there was different like quench materials and, you know, people quench in oil and water and whatever.
Yeah.
But I never thought of like speed rates and that type. When you got into this, was it really, cause okay, let's build a knife. That's super cool. And then all of a sudden it's like, holy crap, there's so much to know. Was it intimidating getting into it?
No, not at all. Ignorance is bliss, right? I didn't know. One of my first knives, I just quenched it into my water bucket and it shattered into like all these different pieces. And I was like, what the heck is going on? Like, that's how they do it on TV. Like, yeah. Just slam it into the water and it makes a knife.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Now you sit down again and start learning a little bit more. Like, it's something that you can learn progressively. Your first knife might be bit of a turd and that's fine. You're proud of it. It's your turd. You made it.
Yeah.
And then the second or third, you end up shattering, and it's honestly all about growth. And that's one of the things that I love about it, because at first you don't have a kiln. Like, they're expensive. They're hard to acquire. Then you acquire your kiln and it opens up this whole other world of using stainless steels and steels that require a bit more precision for your heat treatments. And then you've got this whole other facet of learning that you can just, another rabbit hole to jump down and learn. So that's what I love about it. It's kind of endless.
Yeah. Absolutely. And being okay with making mistakes, like you said, that's how you grow.
For sure. Yeah. Sometimes you can step back and like back up a few steps and correct yourself. But sometimes it's like, well, all right, that one's going in the drawer of of learning, or on the wall of learning. And if it's a real failure, you put it on the wall. If it's not a big failure, you put it in the drawer.
Yeah.
Those big failures I put up on my wall. It's like, don't do that again, buddy.
Yeah.
that was seriously dumb. Like, or not dumb, but I learned something important.
Yeah. Seriously.
You seem very comfortable being open to sharing. Like, lots of people are afraid to say, you know what, I'm still learning and I've watched videos, and you seem really confident and comfortable of, you know what, I'm taking this a day at a time and I'm going to learn on YouTube. I'm going to go practice. Quenching.
Yeah.
Like lots of people get so caught up in the, and I can be like that too. If I don't know how to do something, sometimes that kind of steers me away from it. But you seem to kind of embrace that and be like, no, I'm going to work through all this and come out learning and knowing how to do this. And if I need to go back to something to refresh, like just hearing your stories, I'm like, man, this, the mindset that you have for that and that growth mentality is really a cool feature. And not many people are really open to being like, hey, yeah, this is how I'm doing this. And good on you for that.
It might be from my teaching roots, like trying to instill that in the students of like, hey, it's all right. You just need to redo it, buddy. Like it's not what they want to hear, but it's what's going to make them better. And I think I've kind of instilled that into myself with different projects over time. Like I was not a good wakeboarder. I was like, I could do the odd little thing, but I just loved it. And that's what was important to me. And it led me to learn all these other things, but it was always like, it's about growing and learning, but it's also about loving it. And I love knife making. I love filming. I love doing all that stuff. So if I need to step back and like refresh myself, well, so be it. And do I get frustrated? Do I get pissed off at myself? Yeah. Usually if I can't find my tools, I'm like an organization nut, right? So everyone's got like their issues, but I try to, and I'm on a podcast. I'm trying to be like joyful and energetic.
Yeah. Fair enough.
It seems like a lot of this started kind of around wakeboarding. It seems like that's kind of a
totally, yeah,
a passion. And I, like I said, I mentioned before, I can relate to that in the growth in the sport. I remember being really young and having these family friends I looked up to that were, you know, doing flips and all this crazy stuff. And I was the little kid on the dock going out when I saw their boat in the lake, hoping they'd come by and pick me up. And you start building these skills, and then you keep growing and you take those hard falls and you're like, I don't want to be trying that. Like, I think I got to like a 360 and then there's the flips is the next. I'm like, I've had too many falls in this and I don't want to push my body. So I'm just going to enjoy being in the boat.
Yeah.
You're still part of it, right? You're in that environment, and it's cool how that love and passion for wakeboarding and then the filming has kind of taken you in and branched into this area of blacksmithing and knife making. That's really cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
So what was the point where you realized, or did someone tell you or whatever, where you became okay with the idea of selling your stuff? Because that's got to be, because you know, the standard, knowing the standards and like you said, the first couple, 2-3s like shattered or whatever. And then to get to the point where was there someone who was like, you should really think about selling these or going into business full time? Like, what was that journey like?
Well, it's hard to say, really. I think it was after a few seasons of using my own knives. Like I had mentioned at the beginning, I go canoeing, I go camping all the time. So actually bringing out a knife into the backwoods and just beating the snot out of it. Like, you shouldn't be beating the snot out of your knives. Like, no one should be doing that. But I was like, no, I'm going to beat the snot out of this thing and see if it holds up. Yeah. And they do. So, all right. There's definitely like, I'm doing something right if they can hold up to this amount of abuse. So that kind of led me to think that, okay, well, if I can create that quality for myself, somebody else is going to appreciate that. So I started off with a small kind of like craft sale downtown Winnipeg. It was kind of like a artsy kind of group, and like the tables market were cheap.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a farmer's market or a craft sale. It was more like more artsy people.
Yeah. Like an artisan kind of market.
Yeah. So I went to that and spent a bunch of time on my display, which was a total failure. Like, locked it all left behind glass, which I thought, ooh, people will see the value in it if it's like behind glass. And then people are like, look down into it, into the case, and be like, oh yeah, nice, that's beautiful. And they don't want to touch it because it's behind glass. And like, in reality, you want to like oh, you like knives here? Hang on to this one. And they hold it and they're like, oh man, this feels good. I like the weight of this. Yeah. And then you like kind of get them amped up on it, right? Tell them about the specifics. But yeah, learning from that one sale that I got on that. I made a few sales, actually, a couple sales that day. Craft sales are kind of hit and miss, but yeah, I don't know. But people want knives, man. There's people that collect them. Like,
yeah,
people desire sharp, pointy things. Just like you guys talk about vehicles, like, it's like people love cars. People collect cars. People want nice, shiny cars. Same thing with knives.
What's the process of designing? Like, there's so many different blade types and metal materials and handle materials. People are doing epoxy and wood and a whole bunch of stuff. What's the process like for you to design a shape and a full knife?
Right. Like for myself, I'll just sit down, paper, pencil, sketch it out. I have a little bit of history with like graphic design as well. So lines are important and flow is important. And sometimes like a 16th of an inch or an 1/8 of an inch one way can throw out the look of a knife. So I always like sit and draw, and that process could take 10 minutes if I nail it for some reason, but it could take a couple hours. And then what I was doing originally was taking that drawing, sticking it on a piece of wood, cutting it out so I'd have that template solid. And now I've gotten down to like, okay, now let's scan it into the computer, let's draw it out so I can get that vector file if I want to get it water jetted at one point, and I could just print them out and lay it on the steel and cut it out of the steel and do instead of like forging and blacksmithing, I could just do stock removal, which is like sticking it onto your stock, cutting away until you've got that knife shape in front of you. So
what do you prefer? What part do you like, print, like getting them lasered or like spending, it's probably a lot more time to blacksmith it.
It is. And that is my preference. Like getting that hot work in is fun. And when I was teaching, it was a great way to like let out some steam in the evening. It was kind of like a workout a little bit, and like some of those frustrations out on the anvil.
Yeah.
But still to this day, the hot work is the funnest. But as like trying to run a business behind it, it can work possibly. I'm trying to be a little bit more economical with my time. So stock removal is the way that is the road I'm traveling right now.
I didn't even know that was like an option. Like, that's really cool. Yeah, it is. I'm here to say, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's Lots of guys do it that way. Lots say, no, that's not blacksmithing. Oh, you're right. It's not blacksmithing. It's bladesmithing at this point. Yeah. And I try to mix up between both. Some people want like, no, I want a blacksmith knife. Okay, sure. It'll be this much more expensive. Oh, how much for the stock removal?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go that route.
Yeah, exactly. You got it.
Because
your time is valuable, right?
Exactly.
And I've been seeing, I don't know if it's on TikTok or what, but there seems to be like a trend of these artisans kind of sharing like, no, I'm not going to, like, I'm putting my hard-earned or my blood, sweat, and tears into this thing. And yeah, you could go buy one on Amazon for way cheaper, but
yeah,
my quality. So have you come up against that a lot in your industry?
Yeah, like I still see myself as a beginner entrepreneur. Like my experience is not vast as a lot of the longtime makers, but I still do get that. Like, I had a friend reach out, hey, I want a custom set of Damascus blades for my parents. Like, it's something I've always wanted to get them. Oh, okay, sure. Let me price it out. But like, as a rough estimate, the knives will be like probably like $600-$700 each. And they're like, whoa, what? Like, okay. I think on Amazon, they're like 60 to 100, like maybe 150 for a good one. Yeah, it's not a good one though. Like, That's
like what kind of good material. Are we talking here? Yeah.
Yeah. You hear horror stories of like people using like bumpers and just hammering out to make patterned steel. And it's not hardenable steel. It's not tool steel. So it's never going to make a knife that's going to be sharp and make you happy in the kitchen. That's a realtor, guys.
Yeah. That's interesting. So, getting into Damascus, like that's the big buzzword, like Damascus steel, Damascus, Damascus. What was the learning curve like on that? Is it a completely different?
Yeah. Failure. And then like success. It honestly, the best way to learn that would probably be to have someone show you how to do it. To like, there's certain things that you're looking for within your forge as you're heating up the steel, before you press your steel, the way you lay up your steel. There's like, it's a very finicky recipe that needs to be followed almost perfectly. And my first tries were, like I said, failure. And then you kind of, because I'm self-teaching, I kind of like, oh, I think that's what they're talking about. I see it now in the forge, and then it worked for me. But also on top of that, was investing in a press as well. So I've got it's a 12 or 20 ton press in my shop that I can squeeze out the Damascus and not kill my arm.
Yeah, no kidding. Because you have to fold that stuff a ton, right?
Well, it depends.
Is it folding? I'm before beginner right now. So
yeah, you can fold. That's the route I like to take. I like folding it. But I'll get to that in a second. So what you're doing is you're layering up different types of steel, right? So like the most common is 1084, which is a carbon steel, and 15N20, which is another carbon steel. The steel needs to be clean, like nothing on it. You have to like from the store or whoever you're buying it from, it needs to be sanded down to remove all the mill scale. You need that perfect steel and steel contact. And then you can layer it up right off the bat. You can start with 20 layers of steel if you want to. Squish it down and have a 20 layer billet of Damascus, and that's fine. And that's again one of those rabbit holes where you can like do all these different types of patterns and mosaics. And mosaics is something I haven't done at all. I'm like, I'll learn that at some point. But starting some of those introductory patterns of like different twists or ladder Damascus, raindrop I haven't done, but that's a simple one as well. And you can start with those 20 layers, or you can cut it in half, reforge weld it, or like you said, you can start folding. And that's my preference, because otherwise you need to wait for the steel to cool, cut it, re-sand it down, or you can just put your hot cut in your hardy hole. So your hardy hole is the square hole in your anvil, and you can put different tools in there. And a hot cut is, it kind of looks like an axe head kind of. And what you would do is find your middle point, start cutting through the billet of steel, making sure it's nice and clean again. You're not getting any forge scale, folding it over, and then reforge welding it. And that process is fairly quick, as opposed to leaving everything cool. And will it distort your pattern? Sure, whatever, it's Damascus, it's fine.
Yeah.
it looks good either way. So
thanks for clarifying. I was gonna ask, I know what a Damascus knife is, I don't know the process or what it was, so thanks for clarifying and explaining that, because that's so intriguing.
We can go deeper, man. Like that's like let me keep going a little bit then.
For sure. So
once you have this billet of Damascus and you've made a knife shape out of it, maybe you're forging it, or maybe you're doing stock removal for it as well, because you don't want to distort your pattern. What you do is you etch it in acid. So you get ferric chloride and you're etching it for 15 minute periods, half hour periods, and you lightly sand away the I guess the material that's attaching itself to the steel, so you can access the raw steel again, scratch it away, scratch it away, scratch it away. And what you'll get is hills and valleys, because the 1084 steel is going to be consumed by the ferric chloride, and the 15N20 stays proud. It stays higher up. And what you do is you get these hills and valleys, and the 1084 will darken, and the 15N20 stays nice and shiny. I believe it's the nickel content in the 15N20 that resists that type of acid. And then, yeah, and then you could do a coffee etch as well. Some people use like really, really strong coffee, like the instant coffee stuff.
It's really acidic, right?
Yeah, it's super acidic, especially when you're using like a 1 liter container of that coffee and adding like a liter of water to it. So it's like, it's thick.
Yeah.
And that you soak in it for like 24 hours, 48 hours, and you take it out, and that pattern is like shiny bright on the 15N20, and the 1084 turns black. It's like, black. Wow.
See, yeah. I never knew that it was two different types of steel within like when you do a Damascus. I thought it was just one type of steel called Damascus steel.
Right, right.
It's well, just layering different
it's
materials.
It's more of a process, on. Right?
Yeah, it's a process. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Like people say that's not Damascus steel, because there's a place in India called Damascus, and that's where the name Damascus comes from.
Oh.
And it's because the steel that was coming out of their mine had kind of natural patterns similar to that naturally occurring in their steel. So that's where the name comes from.
Oh,
pattern welded steel is more like the appropriate term.
Yeah.
But
so it's like kind of like champagne. It could only be called champagne if it's from the Champagne region. And
right. Right.
Wow. I never knew that.
Yeah.
Holy,
yeah.
Look at this. You're still into teaching.
I am
whether it's for an official paycheck or not,
right? so
the coloring comes from different material, and the hills and valleys come from what?
The acid eating away the steel.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, it actually removes it actually eats away.
Yeah.
That's cool. I thought it was just like etching it or like putting a a mark on it, but it's actually taking away.
Like you can do a quick etch and you'll see it. And the longer you keep it in the acid, the deeper those valleys become. At one point, it's you can ruin your knife. You can, like, I've heard of people, oh, I forgot it in my acid etch for like a week or whatever, and it my knife is toast. Like that steel is pretty much gone. So it happens.
Wow. That's so cool. I'm learning so much. And it's interesting, like, you're kind of, what am I trying to say? You're kind of setting straight some myths, I think, too. Are there any other, like, myths of blacksmithing and forging and knife making that...
Definitely.
That, like, a lot of things that people assume, but that you want to set straight today?
Yeah, like, there's two of them that kind of stand out the most. The one being that a... hand hammered, like you got to hammer the hardness into the steel, like you got to like work it on the anvil until the steel becomes like better, and that doesn't make sense. Like you're not increasing the quality of your blade by actually working it on an anvil. You're, if anything, you might like make it worse, because you can send in different fractures if you're hammering it cold. If you are hammering it on the anvil, the heat treatment process becomes a bit more complex, because you've brought the temperatures sky high and they've rapidly cooled so many times. So now you got to like normalize your steel. You got to do this extra process that isn't required if you're just doing stock removal. So that's one of the, I guess, the myths. And another one would be, you mentioned the folding. Oh, how many folds does it have? Like,
I fell right into that.
Lots of folds makes a good knife. And it's like, it doesn't matter if it's folded or not. If you have junk steel that is Okay, am I jumping into a myth? No, I'm not sure anymore. If you have like junky steel with impurities, there you might want to be folding it. And in doing so, you might remove some of those impurities. But in modern day steel, folding it doesn't really do anything.
That's
at all.
That's interesting.
At all. Other than change your pattern if it's Damascus.
Because that's what you see on TV and whatever, right? Like it's folding whatever it is. And is that a big thing that you have to? Speaking of myths, like you see, you know, Forged in Fire and all these things. And my example that I use, I've used in a few other, like in regards to cars, you get a show like Overhaulin' where they completely restore a vehicle, quote, in 7 days. And then people go to their local shop and say, well, what do you mean it's going to take 6 months? Or what do you mean it's going to take 4 years or whatever it is? What's your experience with that kind of setting those kind of myths straight?
Yeah, timelines are tough. Like a knife does take a long time. It there's no way around it. Like just the heat treatment could be a couple days, like from... Like, and that's what it takes, because you're not wanting to burn yourself. You're wanting to do the best that you can do. So you're taking your time. And then like just doing the handle on a knife could take a full day, 6 to 8 hours. I have a knife here that was my big project for summer 2021. And I probably have like 40 plus hours soaked into a single knife, because it's got a guard on it. It's got a bolster on it. It's got, or not a bolster, the pommel. You can remove the handle off of it. It's Damascus. Like it can just be just an adding of time. And when you're learning it as well, it's just adding time. So when people say, oh, can I get it like next week? The answer is like, let me check my schedule, but probably not. Like it's not gonna happen. I'm going canoeing, man.
Yeah.
And there's the answer for the Amazon one for $60 or $100 versus a handmade one that takes 40-50 hours. That's reflective in the process, the time, the cost. They can't be, it's not comparable, but lots of people don't see that. They look at it as the price point instead of the quality of materials and the time that it takes you, like 2-3 days for quenching or heat treatment. That how many people understand that time and value that time?
It's all these different steps. Not that heat treatment would take like 2 days, but it's like your kiln needs to come up to temperature. You need to make sure everything, your oil is at the right temperature, that you quench them properly, and then you need to let your kiln cool down, and then you need to temper your knives. You need to do several rounds of tempering. And it's all stuff that like you do kind of in between jobs while you're doing one thing, you can do that. But it's if you're doing a whole bunch of other stuff, it's going to take a couple of days.
In the grand scheme, it's still your time that you're taking into each knife, right? Now,
definitely.
With regards to the handles, you will need to have some, obviously have to have some knowledge in the woodworking parts. So how did you develop that? Or is it kind of similar to your bladesmithing? Have you kind of just kind of explained that process?
Yeah, it's very similar because you're removing material to get down to that shape that you want. My dad was big into woodworking, a little bit in metalwork as well. And I was able to like, hey, dad, how do you do this? Or like, can I borrow your tool for X, Y, or Z? And he'd always like upgrade tools in his shop and like, here, you get a new grinder. Hooray. Or a new sander. Sorry. Yep. So I'd get like the 4x36 sander that he'd pass on to me. And like, as far as shaping and like, it's, I don't know, it's carving. He was also a wood carver. So he'd like make statues of nude women and elephants. I don't know what
odd combination. Things,
teach the road.
Whatever blows your hair back, right?
Yeah, exactly. And he had lots of carving tools, so it was always like in my eye as a child, as a kid, and so none of this stuff really kind of scared me to try and to start. Other than the steel always like, oh, I wish I could do that. I wish I could do that. And then saw the Forge and Fire and some of their janky setups. And I was like, if these guys can do this, I can do this too. So, but, and then to go into the different types of woods and stuff, you want something that's really dense, really hard woods. Some woods will tend to fracture though. So you want to avoid those. And then there's woods that are too soft that you want to avoid as well. And then you could also start stabilizing those soft woods too. So there's a whole process there of like sticking it in a vacuum chamber in what is essentially a, it's a one part epoxy, but it's a two part epoxy, and it's vacuum chambered for 72 hours. Then you bake it and it fills in all those voids and makes it usable as handle material.
Now you're speaking my language. I was going to ask about the stabilizing, and have you played around epoxy and wood on in handles or anything like that? Or
I haven't done like the epoxy and wood, but the vacuum chamber is something that I have done. It's so neat to take like a burl, which is like pitted with holes. It's all gnarly and swirling in different directions. You soak it in like a dyed epoxy, and it's in there for like I said, 72 hours soaking or being vacuumed in. And then you start sanding away that material, and like all these vibrant colors and these dull colors, and like the natural wood shows up, and it's like, I don't know, it's magic every time you start sanding away, and then you pour some water on it and the colors pop, and it's like, oh man, that's gonna make a sick handle.
Yeah. So you've essentially got two shops within your business, that woodworking.
Oh, dude.
Or maybe more.
My office. I have a corner in the basement to do my stabilizing, and then my shop, and then my shed is like my overflow. So, wow. Yeah,
that's so cool.
Lots of little corners.
Yeah,
like you could probably get as meticulous. Like the sky's probably the limit as far as, you know, like do like a, I don't know if you would do on a, like a bigger knife or even like a sword or something, like a bigger handle, like a live edge, something, or like a, what is that? Like a river table kind of idea. Yeah. Or like, the amount of detail you could get into is probably a little overwhelming too.
There's a few makers in Canada that make really nice handles with those styles of knife, of woods, like with the, like the river flow. Whatever it's called, the epoxy stuff. And I haven't gone down that road, but man, some of them are pretty. There's like Norquist Designs. He's out of British Columbia. There's another guy in Ontario that also does it. Beautiful, beautiful stuff.
So you move from 40 to 50 hours to now possibly 80 for a knife, right?
Well, right. Exactly. So that's where, as an entrepreneur, do you start making the stuff for yourself or do you just outsource this? And I'm at the point where it's like, do I make like way more of this wood so I can sell it off as well and make that a revenue stream and take away from the knife making, or stop making it because it's just like this other thing that you have to, how do I do this again? It's been a while. And oh no, my material's gone bad. Oh, do I order more? Oh shoot. It's
like something's got to give, right?
Yeah. Well, and as things give away, try to find your straight line or straighter line to making a dollar on your product.
Yeah.
And that's always a struggle of, you know,
oh, dude.
Like as you're talking about, do you try and dabble into something you've never done before? And now you're doubling the time on a knife and that's going to have to reflect in the cost. Do you stick with what you're good at and what you know how to do? And like that pull each way must be tricky as an entrepreneur to like, do you dive Definitely. Off the deep end and hey, I'm going to give this a shot. And
right.
This knife might be $2,000 if I was accounting for all my time like that. That struggle must be hard to try and incorporate new designs and new things while still, like you said, making a dollar for your product that you're putting that hard work into.
Definitely. But I think you'd mentioned before, like providing tips to the listeners. And this is the one that I've stolen from Gary Vaynerchuk, Gary V. And it's like, it's not a race. It's not something that I was expecting to turnkey, have a viable business and be able to like take time off and go on trips or anything like that. I knew this was going to be like a hard road to travel. And a month or last year I worked full time, so I would have some runway this year so I wouldn't have to teach. And it's a huge struggle, but as time goes on, I'm starting to figure out how to make them a little bit more efficiently, and having that time to experiment and time to like with low expectations is important.
And to develop your processes too, right? Like that R&D almost in a sense.
Definitely. Definitely. And this year has been a lot of that. It's been like getting the shop set up so that I don't not need to walk across the shop three times to like accomplish a task. That shit should be there in front of me. So let's set up a station so I don't need to go back and forth all these times, because all those steps is extra time
and efficiency.
And efficiency. Don't need
30,000 steps a day when you can do it in 5,000.
Yeah. Right? I'm lucky my shop is small. Like it's a 16x18 shop, but at the same time, I don't want to falter by having to walk across, forgetting what I was doing, getting distracted with this or that. And like I just did, got distracted.
It's all good. So on your social media, you posted a couple days ago, was it yesterday, about Bell MTS, and you said we could talk about it on the show. Yeah, big things coming. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. Sure. Well, I'll go back then. A few months ago, I was running a podcast. It's a Canadian podcast where we spoke to blacksmiths and bladesmiths and welders from across Canada. Actually, Rachel Bonnet, that you had interviewed in one of your episodes, she was featured on, I think it was episode 17 of Foresight Chat.
Nice. Actually, yeah, I remember her posting that now that you mention it.
Yeah, she's great. Yeah. She's fantastic. And, while we were recording these podcasts, one of our ideas was to maybe start like a road show where we can go visit different blacksmiths from different people across Canada and film it as kind of like a documentary. And I sent a message out to Bell MTS. I had prior connections from my prior video days from making that wakeboard doc, and said, hey, I'm thinking about like doing something with blacksmithing or bladesmithing, like, and tossed out a few ideas. And he's like, okay, I like that idea, which isn't the one I just mentioned. It's a different idea. So basically they've funded my concept of making three different knives for three different people, and then documenting the knife and documenting the story of the people that are receiving the knife as well. So for example, I have, there's a local entrepreneur, ex-wakeboarder that I used to know fairly well, who's in a super bad motorcycle accident a few years back. And he was like on the stretcher dying pretty much. Horrible, horrible accident. His arm's full of pins. His hands are full of pins. He's gone through multiple surgeries to try to reconnect muscles, and like terrible. And so he can't turn his wrist on the one hand, but he loves fishing. So I'll be documenting the construction of a filleting knife for him, which has a special handle that'll allow him to fillet fish without twisting his wrist.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's going to be the story of him and the story of the knife making, and bundled up into three 15-minute episodes.
That's amazing.
Yeah, connections, man.
Connections and telling the stories.
Yeah, totally, totally.
Love that.
And bringing all your passions together, your knife making, bladesmithing, the filming part. Like, that must be a really cool project
It is. Yeah, definitely. Like, not only is it something that I've always wanted to do, and it's something that, like, I'm YouTubing every now and then. So I've got all these skills built up, and with the storytelling, and it'll be broadcasted on their, like, their public broadcasting, where you can, like, go through their menu and just, like, cycle through different shows.
Oh, cool.
That are on demand, locally made. Yeah. Yeah, it's the on demand stuff. And it's an advertisement for me. So.
Big time. Are you kidding me?
And awesome. I get paid to do it. So bonus. Oh,
even better.
Just making you, yes, making your own opportunities by not being afraid to ask.
Exactly.
Love it.
Yeah.
Love it.
He could have said no, and I would have been, oh, okay, too bad, whatever.
Yeah. But you never know. Like, one of my mentors when I was younger, he said, you can't win the lottery unless you buy a damn ticket, you know? So don't be afraid to, I mean, even with this podcast, yeah, we've just been sending people messages, and people in my, through the lens of my life and my experience, like, these are pretty, like, decent, like, some of the guys that have agreed to come on the show. I'm like, really?
I've been listening.
This is awesome.
Some big names.
And I'm not, and I don't want to say that as, like, an ego thing, but just for me, I'm like, holy smokes, like, this person who, like, Kevin Tate's, for example, big name, like, big name in the car scene. And he's like, yeah, for sure. What do you need? And all we did was ask. But if I would have been like, oh, well, he's been around in the industry forever. He's, look at how many followers he has. They're not going to pay attention to little old me or little old us in this show. But all we did was, like, you know, one of those, like, hit send, you know.
Heart emoji.
Yeah. But, like, hit, you know, grinning and bearing it, hit send, like.
Yeah.
But what's they going to see it? Are they going to ignore it? Whatever. And he was like, nope. So we took a risk, right? Stepped out.
And what's the worst that can happen, though, if you don't reach out to contacts or, hey, I got this idea I want to pitch? You don't, like, the worst they're going to say is, hey, no, or not say anything. So, I mean, have we all been?
There's very little downside.
Yeah.
Very little, right?
If any.
And even if you don't get a response, I mean, this goes for anything, not just, like, reaching out to people on Instagram, but even if, you know, you want to get a mentor in a certain area to develop a certain skill set or whatever, even if they don't even respond, you still benefit from that because you've went out of your comfort zone and you've stretched and you've asked for help and you've humbled yourself a little bit. Do you want to speak a little bit about the importance of humility in making?
Well, yeah, because you could always look up to these beautiful knives that are posted on Instagram and get down on yourself for not having produced that level of excellence and beauty. But you got to put it into the perspective of the years that they've practiced and maybe the people that they've studied under, and try to either formulate a plan or try to figure out what tools you're missing and beg your wife to allow you to buy those things. That's my situation anyway.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very familiar.
Very familiar. But that humility, it's important to have it, but also that drive of, like, no, one day I'm gonna try to get there, and giving yourself that time. Like, people don't give themselves time to learn. They want that skill now. And it's like, and I've talked to makers who have, like, no, I started and I was going for, like, 500 layer Damascus and doing all this. But they leveled up with their tools, like, right off. So they blew the bank. They went out for it.
Not everybody can do that.
No, exactly. Like, I think for most common people, it's like, I'm going to get that one tool, slowly build up and, like, skill up slowly. And I think that's fine. And it's more of an organic way of learning and creating your market as well. Cause you're going to be storytelling this on Instagram or wherever you pop a story on your new tool, and people applaud you for having, like, taken that jump into, like, bettering yourself and bettering your shop, and expecting to have everything right off the bat is, it's tough on the brain. I think it's discouraging. So how do you get that way? maybe consciously reflecting upon it, telling yourself, okay, it's a time thing. I got to wait. I can't afford those tools.
I feel like you acquire those a little bit slowly, like you said, right? Whether it's financial reasons or just slowly building up, you come to understand and know those tools and know how to use them instead of just, I would love a new shop full of everything. But yeah. Now you've got, say, 20 pieces of equipment you need to learn, whereas you get, say, a power hammer or a forge and you're putting all your time into that, you're going to be able to kind of become a master of that one and then slowly build up. So it's not this overwhelming, oh shit, I've got, you know, a forge, a power hammer, this, the anvil, all this stuff. Where do I start? Where you can kind of slowly piece in that slow process.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. My first anvil was like 50 pounds and it's like, wow, I got my first anvil and I was so excited about it. And then bought another one that was like 130 pounds. And I was like, wow, this is great. And then luck happened where I found like a 250 pound anvil. I was like, this is fantastic. I'm so happy. But like if another one knocked on my door that was a little bit cleaner, a little bit bigger, yeah, like
you appreciate it though as you take the time to, right?
100%, 100%. Yeah, definitely appreciate it.
Awesome. The stories and knowledge that you're sharing with us and our guests is amazing. As we kind of get slowly onto the outro wrapping up here, what's some advice for somebody that wants to get into bladesmithing? Do you have any advice for them that want to try it out as a hobby or get into it, jump full bore like yourself to
definitely
start a business?
Yeah. Every province and state or region has a guild or an association. They're like, I'm in Manitoba. We were I think we were the last province to get a guild. And all of these guilds, associations have hammer-ins. So hammer-in is when people get together, they bring out their anvils. Maybe there's specific people that are doing demos. We have one coming up in a week, which is July 23rd. I don't know when this episode is coming out, but there's one in Winnipeg, July 23rd. And we've got one person who's doing copper chasing and repoussé, which is like shaping copper by backing it with pine pitch, and you can like create all like artistic scenes like out of copper. Yeah, really incredible stuff. Look it up. And we've got another blacksmith who's going to be doing forge welding demos. So not so much knives, but differently techniques that boil down to skills that you can bring into your shop. And when you're there, there's going to be 20 guys, 40 guys who are all interested in the same stuff. So if you're new, this is a great way of like spending very little money to get into a group of guys who have maybe some old tools that they don't really use anymore, that they don't mind selling. And I think more importantly, that knowledge base where, hey, I connect with this guy and we're going to meet up and he's going to show me a shop and he's going to show me a couple things, how to improve myself. Like it's idea that to me, it's the best way. And then there's the Facebook groups and YouTube and stuff like that. But that face-to-face connection is, it's ideal.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, with that being said and some great advice there, what about some specific like technical skill sets that one should develop to get into bladesmithing or blacksmithing?
Getting over the fear, right? You're dealing with sparks, you're dealing with hot steel, you're going to burn yourself. Accept it. Like, and assume that it's hot. Like, that's like what we do at our hammer, is like, don't pick it up, assume it's hot, just tap it lightly with the palm of your hand. If it's cool to the touch, then pick it up. Otherwise, don't pick it up. Getting over that fear is important, because when you're grinding knives, we use like a 2-inch by 72-inch grind belt, And we're going through 36 inch grits to, I usually stop at around 400 grit on the grinder. And those initial grits, like you're pushing your body towards this grind belt. And if you're too delicate with it, then you get washed out grinds. You'll get like flats that are not flat, where you intended it to be like a beautiful facet, and it ends up being like convex or flats in different areas. That it's just, it's something to learn, right? Mm-hmm. But that pressure is, for me, one of the things that took me a while to learn, is like, no, you gotta kind of lay into it sometimes and learn the pressure. And it's hours and hours and hours of trying to figure that out for yourself on your own grinder, the height of your grinder, the pitch of your grinder, how much overhang do you want on those belts. There's, get to know your 2x72 really well.
Yeah. Wow. Things in there I've never even really considered. The pressure, it makes sense, but I never thought about that.
Yeah. Well, all these belts, and you could talk about the brands of belts and the different like types of belts. We often use like a ceramic belt, and there's five or six different manufacturers that you can buy from in Canada here. And each one are a little bit different. They wear a little bit differently. It's really, a lot of it is by feel.
Yeah.
And you need to develop that feel.
So it's a lot different sanding your metal blades than your wood handles.
And you can't see it, right? Because you're pushing flat against a grinding belt. So you're not exactly sure what's going on until you lift that knife and check it out. And you're like, oh man, I totally blew it. Like,
went too far. All right,
well, oops. I'll make it look the same on the other side and we're good to go.
Character. It adds character.
Yeah. Sometimes. Yeah.
Talked a little bit about some tools. Top three starting out tools for somebody that wants to become a bladesmith.
Nice. My first knives I made on a 4x36 inch sander, like a Ryobi, just Canadian Tire type deal. That's good. I still have mine. I use it on every knife pretty much, because I'll use it for shaping handles. But my first knife was made on it. Files, hand files, go to garage sales. They're a quarter, 50 cents. If someone's trying to charge you $2 for a file, look them in the eye and say, I buy these for like 50 cents, bud, and I'll give you a loony. So like I've collected so many files from garage sales. They're often still sharp, and they're great for like doing some fine work. Some people on their first knives, they'll create a file jig where they can like lock the file into a vertical post and run the edge of the file continuously down the knife until they create those bevels on their knife.
Oh wow.
So like some guys do that. It takes a lot of labor, but you get a very pretty knife because it's set, it's perfect. It's like you can't really screw it up. I haven't tried, so I can't say that you can't screw that, but it's a cheap way of making your first knife. And then I'll do a couple more. Angle grinder is super important, especially starting off. You can rip through material to shape it, or you can do your bevels if you want to. And then you'll need a torch to heat up your steel. At bare minimum, you can just heat up the edge of like a piece of 1084 or 1095 and quench it in canola oil. Mm. Not water. Do some canola oil and you'll have a hardened edge.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
So taking all these skill sets and the advice and the tools into account, and considering your whole journey, what is your dream build? Like, what is one thing that you're like, man, I wish I could, I'm going to do this.
Yeah. I look at the dream build as my business itself to develop that into something that.
Oh, that's a really cool perspective.
Yeah, because it's still like I look at the knives as a product of my business, and I can make the knives, but the business itself is something that I'm pushing to grow, right? So I'd like to see that develop into something greater, where I don't necessarily need to be the only laborer making everything, where some of it is done by employees or possibly outsourced to other makers. I'm not sure, but I'd like to see it grow. I'd love to have a nice big shop with like all the tools and like everybody, but like to have like manufacturing facility, that would be for myself. I'd love to see that happen at some point. And if it's not that, then it sways one direction or another. Like some people give lessons and that's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't have the insurance for that. Nor the space for it.
Yeah. I guess, yeah, but you need insurance for that.
Yeah.
Definitely. It's not a red, that's not a piece of metal that's painted red, folks. That is actually very, very hot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, hot.
Yeah, exactly. Justin, I could continue talking all day. This has been awesome. I just want to thank you so much for coming on the show, taking time out of your schedule to share your experiences, to share advice and your story with us and our listeners. Thank you so much.
Yeah, happy to be here. It's a treat, guys. And I see you guys are just on your journey of starting this podcast. So I wish you guys good luck and great interviews in the future as well.
So. Really appreciate that. And so for where can people find you and what do you want to promote right now?
Yeah. You can find me everywhere. Rainy Day Forge, website, rainydayforge.ca. And what am I promoting? I don't know. Check out my website. I've got that MTS Stories from Home or 5TV that's going to be coming out right around November, hopefully. And I don't know, connect, reach out, shoot me a message. I'd love to hear from you and give me a follow. I don't know, guys.
We'll link everything into the show notes of the episode.
Beauty. Awesome. Happy to hear it.
Awesome. So look for those in the show notes as well as our other episodes and just how to get in contact with us. Justin, thank you once again for coming on. Thank you, Corey. Thank you, bro. Oh my gosh.
First name basis today.
Yeah. Thanks, Hoff.
Thanks, Rosie.
And we'll see you guys on the next one.